So, good evening, everyone. I'm so glad you're here. We are going to continue our discussion into equanimity. And tonight, we're going to talk about practicing with equanimity, what that looks like. But I think I wanted to start by kind of putting this idea of practicing with equanimity into context, because we're not actually practicing to get equanimity. We need an understanding that we already have equanimity. It's not something that we have to get. It comes out of our practice. It's the natural result of our practice. That's what we talked about the first 2 weeks. This understanding that equanimity is a part of practice and it's part and parcel. It's the result of all this practice. We develop equanimity. So instead, we're practicing equanimity. You're practicing with equanimity more so you can know when it's present and when it's not present. Because as you begin to know when equanimity is present and when equanimity is not present, then you're beginning to see that line that helps us understand the nature of the three characteristics and to understand the Four Noble Truths. That's how we begin to know these concepts of the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, three characteristics. That's how we know it. We know it not because intellectually I know, the First Noble Truth is there is suffering. just thought about this in the movie Kundun, I don't know if you guys have seen that movie, but in the movie Kundun, His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama was a kid, and his teacher was asking him, quizzing him, like in the Tibetan practice, they do a lot of quizzing, and quizzing him on what is the Four Noble Truths. And he said, the Four Noble Truths is the knowing of suffering, and the suffering is caused by grasping, or whatever he said. But he said it in this kind of academic, intellectual way. And his teacher was like, pride. It's pride. That's what it is. This way you're trying to know is where your suffering is coming from. He's like, let that go. Let go of that pride. You just think about what you know, and you answer from there. And then this very young monk, this very young lama, settled in, got quiet, got still, and thought about these little things that had happened that he had seen. And over the course of that, he answered in this very beautiful way. Like you could see the wisdom in him, even at a young age, come out. And that's sort of what we're trying to do. We're trying to trust that equanimity has already come because of our practice. And if we trust that, then we could begin to be still with what is present and begin to see something about the Four Noble Truths and its three characteristics. So in a way, what I begin to learn, and we talked a little bit about this during the talk on energy, this right effort, is that what we're basically doing is every moment of our lives is based on one of three efforts. Either some unwholesome, unskillful action, some unwholesome quality, some unskillful action is present right now, and I'm working on abandoning that. And hopefully included in this abandoning is the idea that I'm going to promise not to bring it back. So I'm going to try to abandon it, bring it back. Because it's here. And I'm going to try to work on letting it go. Or, in this present moment, there is no unskillful, unwholesome. So I'm going to cultivate some wholesome, some skillful quality right here. Every moment, this is what we're doing. One of these three. And if some wholesome or skillful quality arises in that moment, then I'm going to try to sustain it. And that's it. Every moment, we're really just in that moment practicing with whatever it is. And the reason why I think this is so beautiful is because in order to practice with the abandoning of unskillful, unwholesome, arisen energy, qualities or actions, then you got to accept that it's going to arise. And it's part of the right efforts. It's not like the Buddha said, get past all that and then start cultivating the good side. It's sort of right effort includes the abandoning of unskillful, unwholesome actions and the cultivating and sustaining. So inherent in our understanding, there are going to be times when it's not working right. I'm not equanimous. It's not going good. And in those times, you equally have the same capacity for liberation as you do when you're feeling very equanimous and things are going very smoothly. So, we can't really do this, though, if we don't maintain some kind of connection to mindfulness, the interest, curiosity, joy, those uplifting qualities. We can't really do this unless we have the uplifting factors that are helping us stay present with the moment so we don't get caught in it. That's kind of what we're going to talk about. I think the practice of equanimity, when we are cultivating it as a practice, not to get equanimity, but to see that it's already there, then what we're really practicing with are three areas where you could begin to see, you could think of it as, these are the three areas that block me from being able to see that my practice has already generated a level of equanimity. So these three areas are like the clouds, the fog, so I can't see that the equanimity is already there. And then practicing within these three areas, we are in effect cultivating the ability to see the results of our practice. Those three areas I think I want to talk about is, one is disconnection, so it's kind of a distracted way of living, so we're disconnected from life. The hindrances themselves, and this kind of dealing with the unexpected, kind of unintentional impact of our behavior, this purification part. So that's what I want to talk about. That's how I think we can talk about practicing with equanimity in a way that we don't get stuck trying to create equanimity itself. So let me read you a poem. I got a poem I picked out for each one of these little areas. And this one is by Naomi Shihab Nye, which I think is a good way to talk about practicing with our disconnection with life. She writes that this is what her poem starts with. When our English teacher gave the first writing invitation of the year, become a kitchen implement in two descriptive paragraphs. I did not think butcher knife or frying pan. I thought immediately of soft flour showering through the little holes of the shifter and the sifter's pleasing circular swishing sound and wrote it down. Rhonda became a teaspoon, Roberto a funnel, Jim a muffin pan, and Forrest a soup pot. We read our paragraphs out loud. Abby was a blender. Everyone laughed and acted giddy, but the more we thought about it, we were all everything in the whole kitchen, drawers and drainers, singing teapots and grapefruit spoons with serrated edges. We were all the empty cup, the tray. This, said our teacher, is the beauty of a metaphor. It opens doors. What I could not know then was how being a sifter would help me all year long. When bad days came, I would close my eyes and feel them passing through the tiny holes. When good days came, I would try to contain them gently, the way flour remains in the sifter until you turn the handle. Time. I was a sweet sifter in time, and no one ever knew. So in a way, I think what she's talking about is the reason why I wanted to say this poem in relation to this disconnected way that we can live in the world. It's because these kitchen implements, in some respects, they're just like nothing. They're objects, things we don't even pay attention to. What do we care for the sifter or the spoon or whatever? And in a way, when we get disconnected in life, we live our lives out of that kind of not connected way. And it creates a world where all we do is live in objects. We get stuck in going through the motions, not so much living life the way we could. And we are particularly susceptible to this kind of disconnected moving through life when times are hard or difficult. There's a way in which our thinking mind processes difficult times by telling us, just put your head down and let's get through it. You know, just don't get too caught up in it. It's all bad. So just head down, chug right through it, and then we'll get over it, and then we'll get to the good stuff. So there's no need in paying attention because it's all bad. So let's just lower the head, chug right through it. I can't tell you how many times I thought, especially in law school, you know, being a single parent, that's the way I lived, just this kind of close down, get through this semester, that's it. It's all going to be better just as soon as I get out of the school. I got all the way through law school and failed the bar. I had a job that I prayed to God to get that job. I was on bended knees. I promised everything. I was going to give up the kids just to get that job if needed be. Whatever God wanted, you can have it if you give me that job. I got that job. I was so happy. And the guy that didn't get it, oh, you talk about arrogant. I was just too betied. And I just couldn't imagine that this was not working out perfectly for me. I couldn't even imagine. So I started working in July, toward like the end of July, right after law school. Cocky, arrogant, oh, I was too bad. And by September, I did not have a job. Because the announcements came out in September, the job was contingent on me passing the bar, and I did not. I was stunned at the idea that I could not pass the bar. So I just chalked it up as racism. That's just what it is. There's just racism. It can't be me. I mean, really. I took it a second time. And I failed it the second time. And then this thing hit me. Because all my life, I lived in this world of head down, get through it, it's going to be better. Head down, get through it, it's going to be better. It's bad now, but it'll be better. And that way of living kills us. Because we can't see what's going on around us. We can't see the joy. We can't see the engagement in life, the possibility in life, because we're too stuck in the thinking mind's kind of limited view about what it's like. So equanimity is what helps us raise our head up and begin to see the nature of impermanence. The nature of impermanence would have created the possibility for me to accept and be prepared for the possibility that I could fail the bar. That the world doesn't have to plummet to the end because I'm not prepared for something. That it would have helped me come to an understanding that just because I failed the bar, the world was not coming to an end. That there's this idea that things ebb and flow. That I could begin to see more in life. Gil Fronsdale, he says that equanimity, he describes it as seeing with understanding. I like that. And he describes it as standing in the middle of it all. Those are more of the direct translations for the word upekkha. And he says that we cultivate this idea by standing in the middle of it all, or seeing with understanding, we're cultivating the power of observation and inner balance. That's what we're cultivating as part of equanimity. So in impermanence, the impermanence that Buddha's talking about, we're not practicing the impermanence in general. We're practicing, you know, this, we say it a lot. Oh yeah, all things, you know, come and go, changes, passes away. We're not cultivating an intellectual understanding of what impermanence means. We're cultivating an insight understanding of what impermanence means. And the insight of impermanence, of this understanding that impermanence is always a part of life. It is a characteristic of being alive. So this flowing, coming and going is part of life. And the joy is not in somehow or another finding a way to stop it all and get on board and this is it permanently, but in more of this understanding that it's in this flow of coming and going that we're alive. When I went to China, I wanted to share this example of when I went to China. This is, I went to China for my choir several years ago, like 2000. So it's like 2000 because it was before 9/11. And the several people in my choir, you know, were talking to all the guides, every guide that we had, like, you should come to America. Why, you should move to America. America's a great country. You should move to America. I don't know why you'd want to stay here. I mean, it's communist. You should come to America. We have all these freedoms. We hadn't gotten to 2019 yet. This was still back in when we really saw we had everything together in 2000. But one of the guides looked at the couple of choir members and said, "Why do you think I would want to leave China? This is my home. This is where all my family is. Why would I want to leave? Would you want to leave your home?" And the person said, "Yeah, but I mean, we know about your history with Mao Zedong, all of this, you know, surely you would want to leave that." I'll never forget what this woman did. She goes, "I don't think you understand. Chinese history, this. Mao Zedong, this. I just remember thinking to myself, oh my God, it's like you're in a world where things are like 4,000 years old. So you can get this. That is what impermanence is. That's what that is the perspective of the insight of impermanence. Not that things end or, you know, change, but that life itself is this. And this situation you're going through is this. That's what it is. And it's beginning to see that it is an inkling of the nature of the world that we live in. Equanimity helps us see that impermanence. It helps us see that you can engage with this flow like a river, not because you're trying to get over something, but because you understand it flows. Life is alive because it flows. It moves. So the way I think you can practice with this, two ways. One is, what I used to do is pick a day. And this day, I don't care what happens, it's meant to be. That's what it is. So it's I'm supposed to have this come towards me. I would, just to give you an example, this is a simple thing. I'm very picky about food, touchy. I don't like it. So I would go, we had this food court by the prosecutor's office, and I would go to the salad bar so that I could get just the right amount of peas, and they're right here, and the lettuce is here, and then I got the little olives here. I just got everything exactly the same every day. That's what my lunch was. But on the day of equanimity, there was a Mexican restaurant that used to have these long lines. I went there one time to try to eat, and I looked, and they make the plates for you, and I was like, nope, I'm not. That's not going to happen. So on my equanimity day, I would go, get in the line, and take whatever they gave me. Like, whatever, however you put that food on the plate, I'm going to take it. And I need to tell you, it was difficult, but I would look down and say, yes, I'll take some two tacos, some beans, you know, and they're just like, okay, ma'am. Just like, oh, put the foil over it, quick. But the idea is take something simple like that. Something that won't give you an edge, and you take it whatever happens. Like, give the day to everybody. Whatever anybody wants, they get their way. And if you can't give them what they want, then advocate to some way to help them get what they want. It's like you are letting the practice be, whatever comes to me today is the way it's supposed to come. So everybody that's arguing with you, they win. Anybody that says, oh, I think we should do it like this, they get it. It's giving them that. And you do it as a practice so that you're not stuck in some kind of a pushback resistance about it. You're not trying to make yourself give this day. You are engaged with the world just as the world comes to you, whatever that looks like. You don't know how it's going to come to you, and you can't decide. Just whatever it is, you can't change anything, and you let it flow however it is. Or I also think the Brahma Vihara phrases are a good practice for cultivating equanimity. Because saying those phrases, I wrote a couple of, just like three of them down. So, may I have or may I know balance and harmony in this moment? Or may I know or have balance and harmony in life? You just say that phrase as a mantra throughout the day for me, for my friends, for my family, for people I don't even know. May you have harmony and balance in your life. May you know it in this moment. And you just send it out all over the place. You're not trying to make yourself have equanimity. You are allowing yourself to feel access to equanimity so that your disconnect from the world doesn't block you. That's what you're trying to do. So may I be open and receptive in this moment or in life? And regardless of my wishes for myself, I cannot control everything. So may I have or find strength with myself, come what may. May I find it in myself, come what may. Regardless of my wishes for you, I can't control whether you're happy or not. So may you find happiness within yourself, come what may. It's this way in which you're cultivating these phrases to help you engage in life on purpose. And that equanimity helps us engage. And when we get engaged, we let go of the need to make things permanently solid. And we can open to this flow of impermanence. So the second way, I think we our equanimity that we already have gets blocked is with the hindrances. So I got a poem here. This is from Barbara Crocker. She says, in the middle of a life as complicated as everyone else's, struggling for balance, juggling time, the mantle clock that was my grandfather's has stopped at 9:20. We haven't had time to get it repaired. The brass pendulum is still. The chimes don't ring. One day I look out the window, green summer. The next, the leaves have already fallen, and a gray sky lowers the horizon. Our children almost grown, our parents gone. It happens so fast. Each day we must learn again how to love between morning's quick coffee and evening's slow return. Steam from a pot of soup rises, mixing with the yeasty smell of baking bread, our bodies twined, and the black dog pushes his great head between his tail, a metronome, three-quarter time. We'll never get there. Time is always ahead of us, running down the beach, urging us faster, faster. But sometimes we take off our watches. Sometimes we lie in the hammock, caught between the mesh of rope and the net of stars, suspended, tangled up in love, running out of time. So in a way, I think this points to the hindrances, because the hindrances are all around us all the time. We're always caught in this kind of pressure cooker between the eight worldly winds we talked about the first 2 weeks. And, you know, how do I get what I need to be happy? We're always caught in this attachment and resistance all the time, pushing back and forth. I think that equanimity is dukkha. I think it's the aspect of dukkha that we get caught up with. It's the dukkha part of the three characteristics. So the insight we want to learn is, in this ever-flowing life of impermanence, means that we are subject to dukkha. We are subject to conditions forever changing. We kind of all know all this. I know. I feel it. I mean, students come and talk to me all the time, and they're tell me some situation, I'll say, oh, this is a version. And they're like, I know. How come I can't remember? Don't be upset. When I go on retreat, that's what happens to me. I'm like, dang it. I teach about this and I can't even remember. And it, I think it's because the hindrances are our life. It's like trying to remember that you're breathing in air, right? You can't see that. You don't know it. It's just there. So I don't think our practice is about remembering. I think we need to stop trying to remember that the hindrances are all around us. Instead, we want our practice to remember. We want our cultivation of equanimity to remind us, to be there. So we're just trying to ride this candlelight between the 17th and the 18th mile. We're just trying to ride that candlelight to see when the hindrances are blocking us and when they are not. We don't need to remember whether or not, oh, this is aversion. Oh, this is desire. We just need to learn how to feel that discomfort. Because when aversion is around, there is discomfort. So the reason why we don't remember is because we're not feeling the pain. And as soon as somebody touches it, then we can, oh, I feel that. And then we can let it go. There's a way in which we have to drop down in the body and begin to practice feeling the pain of it, feeling the suffering of life, feeling the rub of it, so that we know. And equanimity is that practice that helps us feel that. So a long time ago, I stopped operating under this understanding that I somehow or another was going to ever get past the hindrances. I stopped operating under the idea that I was going to be perfect. And instead, I operate under the assumption that there's some hindrance somewhere blocking something. And so there's always this willingness to try to see what is it that's being blocked. And I've come to a point, most of you that know me, I'm okay seeing a fault. I'm okay seeing something not quite right. Or I was on this online class, and one of the gentlemen that was in the class I was teaching, you know, he's sort of like me, a man after my own heart, talks all the time. So I got like 12 people on this call, and I'm trying to, everybody's got to talk so I can evaluate them at the end. And so I would say, oh, I'm sorry, let's hear if somebody else is talking. So I was always saying, don't talk, don't talk, don't talk, don't talk, don't talk. And, well, wait a minute, we'll get back to you in just a minute. And then one day, after they had their little breakout session, this is probably like the third week into the class, no one in his group was talking. So I said, oh, you can probably share. Your group will probably love it if you say something. Oh my God. He took that as if I were controlling him. Like, you can't talk now, and now you can talk, and then you can't. And he lost it on this video chat forum. I think he was at the point of about to cry. Like, I had embarrassed him so much, and he did not want me controlling his behavior and telling him when he could talk and when he couldn't talk. And I did not say anything. And then after he finished, he's like, I can't take this anymore. You can't treat me this way. I just apologized. Like, I'm not trying to embarrass you. I'm not trying to do this. And I tried to explain what it was that I was trying to do and reassured him. I probably should have explained that more in the beginning instead of being so quick with it, you know, and I could see where he could feel that way. But the thing that struck me was I was so embarrassed. I could not contain myself. I was so embarrassed. So part of the reason why I wasn't saying anything and I'm letting him go on and on and on is because I'm trying to practice coming down in the body. Like, don't freak out here to where he settled down. Because my impulse was to push back. Like, no, I have to do this. What are you talking about? Oh, and so instead, I am practicing listening to him steady, and then told him, and he just became one of the best students out of the whole group, because he would engage the whole group so everybody would talk. It's, if I had never learned to be with discomfort, I would have been reactive. That's when we say, how do I stop being so reactive? It is because we are always, the mind, as soon as it feels discomfort, it's going to push that discomfort away immediately without even thinking. And we just follow it. But when you begin to practice with the felt sense of discomfort, then you can be with discomfort. That's the result of equanimity. We can be with discomfort, even though we don't have, even though the discomfort doesn't go away, we can be with it long enough to get our composure, or as Gil Fronsdal would say, this kind of inner balance that we can speak from, more from non-harming. So the way I think that we can practice with this, to kind of cultivate this understanding, is that we, it's sort of like you have to be willing to not get your way. So you know how we go through life and we have an opinion about everything. And we have an opinion based in what we know is right. So whatever is against that opinion is wrong. We practice the actual cultivation of learning to feel suffering by giving up that opinion. And we give it up when we think we're right. That's what makes it important. If you give up an opinion by saying, okay, you know, I guess, okay, I'll let, yeah, let's do it your way. If you do it like that, then you're not really feeling the pain of you think you're right. So you got to do this when you really think you're right and they are wrong. And out of the goodness of your heart, you are going to let them have it. You are letting it go as a practice itself of renunciation. Or when you really, really want something, and that's it, I want it, you gotta let that go. Not gonna take it, just gonna let it go. Or you really, really don't want something, and you take it anyway. It's sort of like you're practicing with allowing yourself, it's like you have to give yourself permission to go against the mind's automatic belief that it shouldn't be this way. If I think I'm right, then I'm right. That's just it. And giving up, giving someone else the win is a difficult thing to do, but that's how you're going to feel this discomfort. This is the only way I could begin to see a way to feel discomfort, because mostly we want to find a way to resolve the discomfort. And you don't want to do that. You don't want to resolve it into a, I'm okay with this being this way. Because that resolve ultimately bypasses the truth of equanimity. The truth of equanimity means you can hold a sense of balance and wisdom in the midst of something difficult. And so I think the best way to practice with this is when you don't really want to give up something. Like with your partner, it's got to be the sticky ones. You know, with people that you really care about, your kids, when you know they are wrong and you know you are right, you give it to them. You let them have it. And you are going to get stuck. It's going to keep coming back up. But every time it keeps coming back up, you let it go. Let them have it. It's this practice of feeling it come up and letting it go so you can feel the liberation. And if you truly let it go, you will feel the liberation. It will come back. You're not letting it go forever. You're letting it go in the moment, and you can feel this liberation. And then a couple hours later, it'll be right back. But there's a way in which practicing with that as a practice helps you feel that kind of space where the light appears and disappears that Alzolinoff was talking about in that poem, in under ideal conditions. So you're kind of like working under the ideal conditions. So I have one more, and we won't be spending a lot of time on it. But I do want to talk about a poem. It's called The Moment. It's written by Margaret Atwood. She says, the moment when, after many years of hard work and a long voyage, you stand in the center of your room, your house, your half acre, square mile, island, country, knowing at last how you got there. And you say, I own this. In the same moment, in that same moment, is when the trees unloose their soft arms from around you. The birds take back their language. The cliff fissure and collapse. The air moves back from you like a wave and you can't breathe. No, they all whisper. You own nothing. You were a visitor. Time after time, climbing the hill, planting the flag, proclaiming. But we never belonged to you. You never found us. It was always the other way around. So there's a way. This, I think, is the last part of what blocks us in equanimity, is having to deal with our past actions. Because part of this practice comes with it a degree of purification. We can't practice with these altruistic thoughts and concepts of kindness and loving and non-harm and being interrelated with people without remembering some of the harm that we have caused in the past, some of our behaviors, some of the things we've done, some of the things we've said. We can't practice these altruistic thoughts and not come face to face with the fact that we have been so unskillful throughout our lives. And the point is to connect to that unskillfulness, to begin to see what it feels like when we cause harm, to begin to know and understand the pain of this kind of mine and me and selfing that goes on in the world in our lives. So this is how we come in relationship with the last characteristic of non-self. That this equanimity helps us begin to see non-self. We can't even touch into equanimity without coming to terms with the balancing factor of non-self. Anatta is sort of this way, like I think if the Buddha did not bring that non-self into his practice, then equanimity wouldn't really be possible. Because what we're learning is that much of what happens in our lives is habit. It is a response, a reflex, an impulse. And equanimity is learning to not take the bait when the world pushes and we immediately push back. We're practicing with learning how not to take the bait. And we learn that by having this equanimous way of holding the arising awareness of our past harm and our past karma. The more we're able to let go of this notion of I, me, and mine, the more we're able to hold the awareness of our past unskillfulness in ease. I know I'm going to say this guy, this monk's name wrong, but his name is Nyanaponika. Anyway, I'm going to spell it for you. It's Nyanaponika. It's Nyanaponika. That's it. Nyanaponika Thera. Someone help me learn it, and then I can't pronounce it. Nyanaponika Thera. He's a monk who's dead. He was born in Germany. Sri Lankan monk, and he's a scholar. He writes a lot of, translated a lot of the works that we use. Anyway, he's the one that called equanimity an unshakable balance of mind rooted in insight. And in this article he wrote, he went on to say that to establish equanimity as an unshakable state of mind, one has to give up all possessive thoughts of mind, like M-I-N-E, and all egotistical thoughts of self. So to me, what that means is, if you go around thinking, oh, I messed up, I did this wrong, I'm a bad person, I'm lost, I'm mean, I'm hurtful, I'm selfish, all that stuff that we think about me, then you set in motion this idea that it can never change because that's who you are. But if you see it as there was a moment in time when I did something unskillful, unwholesome, that your practice can come in and help you see through this equanimity that you are not the same being that did that unskillful act. And we can learn to shake off a lot of this waywardness, some of the difficulty we do. So the last practice I want to leave you with that I think we can, that helps us cultivate this kind of non-self understanding is the five recollections. So practicing daily with this idea that you are of the nature, we are of the nature to get sick. And nothing and no one can change that. Practicing with the understanding that we are of the nature to grow old. And nothing and no one can change that. We are of the nature to die. Nothing and no one can change that. That everything we own, everything that is of value to us, will change and vanish over time. Nothing and no one can change that. And then this final One is that we are all the owners of our own intentional acts, and that whatever, and their effects. So we're born of it, we live with it, and whatever we do, whether it's good or bad, we're the ones that are going to be responsible for it. So if we say those five recollections, we begin to realize that we are not in control of everything. There are some things that we cannot control, and those things that we cannot control is what helps us begin to experience the insight of anatta. So I'll leave with a poem. I'll end this here. It's by Lynn Unger. And she says that one morning you might wake up to realize the knot in your stomach has loosened itself and slipped away, and that the pit of unfilled longing in your heart had gradually, and without you really noticing, been filled in, patched like a pothole. Not quite the same as it was, but good enough. And in that moment, it might occur to you that your life, though not the way you planned it, and maybe even not entirely the way you wanted it, is nonetheless persistently, abundantly, miraculously, exactly what it is. So we'll see. Sit with that for a moment. Thank you for your kind attention. I'll see if there's any comments or questions. Yeah.
What you said about the unskillful way of letting other people be right, because I think I've kind of perfected that.
Yes. Join the club.
Little self, you know, subtle message.
That's right. Yes, we know.
And what you said really helped me see the value in not putting that in.
Yeah. So the comment was that seeing the this idea I was saying about letting people be right without that little twist of, but we know I am, that kind of energy. And she was saying that she could see the value in that. That is the reason why you do that, is specifically to help you remember this is all about practice. It's not about who's right or wrong. In opinions, it's all opinion. But if we're going to practice with the felt sense of what it feels like when we're attached to our view or attached to our opinion, we have to let someone else have it so we can feel that resistance of really not wanting to give it to them. And there's something in that, it's something about practicing with giving myself permission to feel upset that really changed the way I begin to practice. Because in a way, when we practice, we think we shouldn't be upset. So everything we do is to try to make me not upset. And how do I practice in such a way so I'm not upset anymore? And that doesn't work. Instead, we want to be upset It's like, good. Oh, woo, I'm mad. Oh, thank God. You know, let me give myself some credit here. And now I'm going to work on it. You know, so that's what it points to. Yeah.
I think I really see the value of that practice in terms of practicing to be okay with being upset. I get that, but I have caveat, and this may just be a way of trying to get out. What comes to mind is, you know, if I am convinced, and I mean, there are opinions, but sometimes there's something like facts, perhaps. Let's say that other person is wrong, and I tell them, oh no, you're right, just to practice with that discomfort. Isn't that also not speaking the truth? Are you also committed to speaking the truth? And what if that has consequences down the road? Because that, I mean, we can never undo that. Once we give that person that, we can't, what if negative consequences arise? And later on we'll say, oh, but I really need to tell you, you're mistaken. And then they'll say, well, why did you say that back then?
So the comment is, what do we do about those situations when, you know, the person's wrong and, you know, we're saying, okay, you're right, and, you know, it's like we're telling a lie. We don't really, you know, is it right speech is what I think you're pointing at when we say you're right. And so this is the way I think I would have the take on that. You're not trying to lie. What you're doing is you are not necessarily telling the person you're right. You are telling yourself to let that go. That's what you're, this practice is more about you telling yourself to let it go. And the ability for you to tell someone, the ability for you to let someone else be right when you think they're wrong is almost impossible in the mind. It's like the mind just is like, nope, they are not right. But it's beginning to understand we're only talking about opinions here. We're not talking about telling someone who is causing direct harm, continue with that harm. That's not what we're talking here. We're talking about the tensions that we get into because I think it should be this way and you think it should be that way. Or I think more people should be this way and I think more people should be that way. Or just to make it real, you come up against someone who's like a white supremacist, and they hate all black people. They think all black people are terrible. I can't believe that. I certainly can't tell them they're right. That's got to be wrong. But if you're going to ultimately understand how to be in this inner balance, this inner strength, because a white supremacist opinion is not your opinion. It's their opinion. And we can get caught in arguing against their opinion, but we're not necessarily changing that opinion at all. Right? So the idea is you are telling yourself they can have their opinion. That's basically what you're doing. You're not trying to change or make their opinion wrong so that your opinion rules the day. That's what you're basically doing. Letting people have their own opinions. Do I think some of these opinions are wrong? Oh my God, I'm a Virgo. I think most people's opinions are wrong. Let's just get it out there. But I have, it is a quality that we have to learn how to let other people have their opinions, because much of our life is spent in opposition and resistance to things we have no capacity to control. And we are stuck in that tension all the time, as if the thinking mind thinks, oh, I can fix this, but we cannot. And so this is more about you practicing, how do I let them have their opinion for themselves? That's what you're practicing. And so the rightness is not, I got to go up to that white supremacist and say, you're right. It's not that. It's you're not arguing with it anymore. Like, okay, well, you can have that. And I'm not going to argue with it. Even though as soon as you leave, you got to know it's coming back. That's the point of it. It's going to keep coming back because we're stuck.